Hello, you're listening to the Doctor Who Review Show 2015. Hybrid has been mentioned once or twice in the current series of Doctor Who, and call me Mr. Suspicious, but I wouldn't be surprised if this was deliberate and could form part of the series finale. Here's where hybrids have popped up so far this series. The first mention we get is in The Witch's Familiar. As every Dalek on Skarrow is revitalised with Time Lord regenerative energy, Davros reminds the Doctor of a Gallifreyan prophecy of two great races coming together to create the Ultimate Warrior. Could it be the Time Lords and the Daleks? In The Girl Who Died, Ashilda is brought back to life by integrating Maya technology into her, meaning she is indeed a hybrid. The same thing happens to Sam Swift in The Woman Who Lived, meaning we now have two human Maya hybrids tootling around. Double bubble in The Zygon Invasion Inversion, two Osgoods, both claiming to be of Zygon and human genetics. But does it go back further than just this series? Stephen Moffat loves a long game and loves not only tying up loose ends, but making loose ends to play with later on. Perhaps the hybrid has been under our noses all along. Let's have a look at the potential hybrids. Clara. Perhaps Davros is wrong and the great warrior hybrid is half Dalek and half human. The first time we met Clara, she was inside a Dalek, and we've even had a reminder of that in The Witch's Familiar. And as for humans being dangerous warriors, the Doctor himself said how hard they find it to deal with peace. And then again, the Doctor should be careful what he says. Clara's last words to him in Face the Raven were, "Don't be a warrior, be a doctor," which leads us to our next contender, the Doctor himself. Let's not forget in the 1996 TV movie we discovered that the Doctor was half human on his mother's side. Death follows the Doctor, and when he's on his own, he is indeed a dangerous man. Could the Doctor himself be the hybrid? Is that why he left Gallifrey? Or did he leave because the hybrid is Susan! Who knows how far back traps for the Time War were set. Perhaps the Daleks were causing problems before the Doctor even met them. Perhaps he wanted to get Susan to safety, and where safer than doing peace work on future Earth after a Dalek invasion. What about Ashilda? And let's face it, Osgood. They're both blatant hybrids created by the Doctor. Ashilda has been used by something or someone. Could she be a weapon? And as for Osgood, even the Doctor can't see where Zygon begins and human ends. With the Doctor in the dark, could Osgood be more dangerous than we would possibly imagine? River's Song! And why not? She is coming back at Christmas after all. Remember, she is a human born of the TARDIS with some Time Lord traits. Stolen at birth and raised as a weapon, perhaps the Dalek in Big Bang was scared of her for reasons we're only about to discover now. Or perhaps it's someone new. Let's face it, Moffat likes to introduce people from the Doctor's timeline we don't know about, like River or Tasha Lemin, the time of the Doctor. It would be fairly typical after we've discussed all the possibilities that the Moffster would do this to us. Well, there isn't long before we do find out just how the series is going to end and just who the hybrid is.
So who is the
hybrid?
Let's
see what the rest of the team think.
I think there's only one person it can be, the Doctor himself. All the other mentions of hybrids we've seen in this series, Ashilda, probably Sam Swift, Osgood, even Clara, they're all red herrings to lead us off the scent. It's that old Moffat staple of hiding stuff in plain sight, the magician's illusion of distracting you with something on the left while the real trick is going on over on the right. Why do I think it's the Doctor? Well, it's definitely all tied up with the fate of Clara. All the signs are there. She's going to die very soon. And I'm actually starting to wonder if we're seeing the episodes in the right order. The trailer for Face the Raven shows the Doctor in his velvet jacket and buttoned-up shirt combo. What if this next episode comes first for the Doctor? Clara gets killed. He goes back in time to have a few more adventures with her before risking everything to try and save her from death. Someone wants to create a Dalek Time Lord hybrid, and I'm betting it's the residents of Gallifrey, not the tin cans from Skarrow. To rescue Clara, the Doctor's going to have to become the thing he fears the most, the thing he's been running away from all these years. A Dalek Time Lord weapon. Then again, bearing in mind I've noticed a lot of callbacks to the Sylvester McCoy era during Series 9, It could just turn out to be the Candyman, after all.
Come in, mate. Come in. I've done what you asked. I've souped up your yellow Edwardian Roadster. It now runs on a mixture of standard petroleum, water, and Artron energy, as requested, sir.
Excellent, excellent. So, Bessie, is now a hybrid ace?
Hello. Yes. Aha. That was my little joke. So, yes, this hybrid thing, this is a word that's being bandied about, isn't it? In literally most stories we've had so far this year, someone has referred to something as being a hybrid. Let's look at the options. Let's imagine for a second that the hybrid is going to be turn out to be the Doctor. That's why he left Gallifrey. You can't really make yourself a hybrid, you know? He can't have got to, you know, halfway through his first incarnation as William Hartnell and thought, do you know what, I'm going to make myself half human and Scarper so that no one knows. It's not like the Gallifreyan equivalent of getting a tattoo. What's more likely is that the hybrid that we're racing towards this year is going to be at least 50% Clara Oswald, because it sounds like a big ominous... I mean, it's a story arc, so it's going to be a big climactic thing. We know that Clara is heading towards a big climactic ending where she will either die screaming in insufferable agony or quietly leave the TARDIS and settle down to a sedate life of teaching. We don't actually know that she's going to die at all. Just remind everyone. Could the Doctor turn Clara into a weapon? Of course not. He would never do that. Would Clara inadvertently turn herself into some weird human Time Lord hybrid just to save the Doctor? Yes, she would, because she's got that kind of hubris, that kind of confidence that's becoming arrogance. But that would really just be a retelling of what Rose did to try and save the Ninth Doctor, wouldn't it, when she absorbed all the energy from the time vortex or whatever it was and went a bit glowy and a bit yellow and could magic. She literally hand-waved away massive Dalek armies. So I'd be more interested if there was some other idea on the table. Perhaps Missy could turn out to be a hybrid. Perhaps Davros could turn out to be a hybrid. I'm just saying. I'm just putting that out there. All right.
I think the hybrid is River Song. I mean, she's part human, part Time Lord. There you go.
Right. This is the question that I need to ask you. Although I don't actually think it's a question, but here we go. Who is the hybrid, and why do you think this is?
That's two questions.
Okay.
Well, the hybrid is clearly the dust snot monster. They're made of dust, and they're made of snot.
Exactly. That's good. Yeah. So why do you think... Oh, that's
the
it.
The series has been building up to them.
To Attack of the Dust Snot Creatures.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the entire series has been building towards. And it's really obvious, actually, when you go back and watch, like, you know, the first episode.
Uh-huh.
Because think about it. It had lots of snot-related looking things.
The only way to kill them is to eat them. You have to conquer your social anxiety and chew your bogeys.
What?
I don't know. I think the actual answer is the question. It's who is the hybrid? Just take the question mark off. Which is what I've been saying since, ooh, I think, week one.
It's the dust snot monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You and me.
Me and you.
Lots of love.
For you to do.
Lots of love.
For you to see.
Me and you, you and me.
Hello, it's Andy here, and I am joined by a very special guest on this section of the podcast. It's Mr. J.R. Southall. Hello, J.R.
Hello. Oh, I nearly said your real name. Oh, can I say your real name?
I'm Andy on this, but you can still call me Rev if you want, for old time's sake.
Oh, can I call you Viz?
You can call me whatever you like.
Okay, I'm calling you Viz, because that's what it says in your Skype feed.
Does it? Okay.
Fair enough.
When you say I'm a very special guest, I hope you mean special in the way I want you to mean special.
Special as in you're an amazing writer for Starburst magazine. You're a godfather of Doctor Who podcasting and the executive director of Watching Books, which we're going to come on to hopefully, and talk about some very exciting news. But
first...
Yes, we're here to talk about the Doctor Who episode, which I forgot the title already. What was it called?
Sleep No More.
Of course it was. There you go. What about Gatiss fan I am. What?
Okay, I've got a question for you.
Go on then.
Did it send you to sleep?
No, it didn't send me to sleep, but I think I had to watch it more times than Ghost Light to actually get it. No, I had to watch it twice before it sunk in this one.
All right.
But it didn't send me to sleep. I did enjoy it. But what I didn't enjoy so much, and this was, I don't know if this was sort of going to be my question to you or where this will go, but when they announced it was going to be a found footage episode and it would be Matt Gatiss and it would be Rhys Shearsmith, I was very excited because they're three ingredients which I thought would work really well together. And I was enjoying it. I liked how it was going, but what I actually didn't like at the end was the fact that it wasn't a found footage episode. No. That was actually leading up to the ending, and the ending was intrinsic to the fact that there weren't any cameras or anything like that. It all linked in too much. I would have liked just a straightforward found footage mystery.
Yeah, that was the thing that disappointed me, is that the elements didn't really fit together. Sort of found footage thing with the sort of, the sort of conceit behind the monsters, it just sort of felt unfulfilling in the end, because it wasn't really one thing or another. Do you know what I mean?
No, it was more like a Twilight Zone episode at the end, wasn't it? I think that was the biggest disappointment for me in it. And the other thing I thought, this is interesting, that I think it was the interview in Doctor Who magazine bigged it up quite a lot as being a political satire, which sort of mentioned the Sunmakers, but in my head it made me think of things like the Happiness Patrol and Paradise Towers.
I've not read I didn't get around to reading that before.
Yeah, so that I sort of went into it with this vibe that it was going to be sort of that kind of thing. But that was going to lead to another question, in that I think the single episode format didn't let them expand on that, and you didn't really get much of that. I mean, apart from the hologram telling you exactly what Morpheus was, why it existed, was really the only bit of political satire you got in it, rather than the way it sort of said it was going to be.
Oh, that completely passed me by, I've got to be honest. If you hadn't have said that just now, I wouldn't have even recognised that was one of the elements, to be honest.
Because that is one of the areas of the original series that sort of would be nice and ripe to pick, wouldn't it, and plough into.
Well, they did it with the Zygon story.
They did, yes.
Basically, yeah. I suppose, even if that was an element of Sleep No More, coming after the Zygon story, you were never going to notice unless it was really in your face.
Another thing that I felt, now you brought the Zygon story up, this is an interesting thing, because I know that you did say something along similar lines yourself when I was listening to Blue Box. Let's name check the podcast there.
Yeah.
Whereby you said that the Zygon episodes you felt could be a series on their own and a good starting point. Well, I agree with that. I thought, what a great place to start a series if this was it being rebooted again. You know, you could tweak it with some bits that you might have had in Rose in it, but this would be great. I actually felt the same about this one because of the way it opened, with the lack of titles and the different way of opening it. They were very different episodes, very unique episodes, but could have been really good starting points.
Well, this thing that's coming up, Class, I've no idea whether... I think that's 8 episodes, isn't it, they've said? Or 10? 8, I think it is. But they could be 8 standalone episodes, or it could be a serial, for all we know.
Yeah, it could.
So, you know, there's potential... If it's a serial, there's potential there to do something along the lines of this Zygon story for 8 whole weeks and really get into it in depth. You know, if it was me, I'd probably stick the Zygons in it. I think I'd make Class the sort of Zygon serial that the Zygon story could have been. But I certainly wouldn't put any snot monsters in it.
You wouldn't put snot monsters in. What did you think of the monsters in Sleep No More?
Well, they were okay, but we'd seen basically the same design in Hyde. Not to mention Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. The design was like the design in Hyde, and the concept was fairly similar to Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, where it's kind of, I say snot, ice snot, whatever you want to call it. But those monsters were sort of created out of the people, and then they were coming to get the people. Just like in Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, the monsters there were created out of the people and coming to get the people. I don't know, it just felt like a combination of those two things. It didn't do either concept enough justice for it to sort of stand up on its own. And basically, you just end up wondering, well, how does Icenot turn into a monster? Well, I've got a question for you then, I've got a couple of questions, but I'll go with this one first. So, the end of the episode, where you find out that it's not found footage, and actually this chap played by Rhys Shearsmith has been editing this whole thing together himself, presumably out of things that actually happened, but manipulating it so that people would want to watch the footage. And that's the twist at the end. And the twist at the end, I thought, was the best thing about it, in spite of the fact that it's basically the same twist as in, The Ring. But I still thought that twist at the end was one of the best things about it, and that kids watching it would, be thinking afterwards, oh my God, he won! He got his message out. He won! For once in Doctor Who, the Doctor didn't win. And then Mark Gatiss comes up on the Doctor Who Festival at the weekend and says, oh, I'm thinking of writing a sequel. What do you think of the idea of there being a sequel to this?
Well, I don't know. It could be interesting because, I mean, when they said they were doing a sequel to the Zygon element of the Day of the Doctor, I wondered how that would work. And I went into that with the feeling that it wasn't going to work very well, but it blew my socks off. So it might blow my socks off, but I don't know. I mean, there were so many good things about that Matt Gatiss episode that were spot on. I wonder if it's not as perfect as he wanted, and that's why he's writing a sequel, because he wants to get it perfect.
Well, he said that he'd quite like to do basically a Peladon.
Right.
Where you go back and sort of read.
Yeah.
But I think he's also said that the story he'd write would be down on the surface of Triton, was it?
Okay.
When the monsters turn up there.
Okay.
I think basically that's what he said the story would be.
So it's basically Alien and Aliens. And what they did with the Weeping Angels as well, isn't it? They had one and they had many.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where they're going. Well, I mean, it goes back to the thing about the political satire element missing, and it felt like it could be more episodes. And again, in the same interview, on Doctor Who magazine, he'd said that he'd always wanted it to be a two-parter, but felt then that later on it would fit better in a single episode. And I think for once I actually watched it thinking, actually, this has got more room to be expanded. There's other stuff could have been in here. Especially, now that I've heard about the background of Morpheus and the potential political thing.
Yeah.
I think it was mentioned to him as well in the recording of it by the director. So is this a sequel to Sunmakers? So it's possible he might want to expand that element of it.
Yeah, maybe.
So,
well, I mean, if you go down onto the planet's surface, that gives you a lot more room to push the political side of it, doesn't it?
I don't think you can really expand the sleep monsters much more. I mean, that's it. They've done what they do, haven't they?
Yeah. And yet, that looks like it's going to be the basis for what the sequel will be.
Yeah, there's been a lot of sleep monsters and dream stuff, though, hasn't there?
I know.
Going back to the Christmas special.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like it's a very Stephen Moffat thing to do. In fact, the idea that the dust is intelligent and is recording what people are doing is not a million miles away from the Vashta Narada.
It's not. And we've also, what did the dust, we had dust in the Weeping Angels episode, didn't we? Coming out of Amy Pond's eyes, she cried dust.
Yeah, we did. Yeah,
I can't quite remember why that was. That was the angel getting in her eye, wasn't it? And possessing her, that's right. Yeah.
If you're what, if you look upon an angel, yeah, you turn into an angel or something. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a trait that's run through, hasn't it?
I mean, Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who's are always very much about the eyes and the sort of visual aspect.
He takes
the expression television at its word and uses that visual thing very much.
Absolutely.
All right, I've got another question if you like.
Why not?
Okay. Well, this one's a bit more of a downer, though, I think. Possibly. What did you think of the use of the first transgender actor in Doctor Who? And do you think it was worthwhile having her in there?
Actors need acting jobs. I don't know if he really needed to make a fuss about him being transgender. It was just an acting job, wasn't it? Maybe it drew attention to the episode for the wrong reasons.
I have to say, I thought she was miscast myself. Yeah. If you're going to grow and breed soldiers in the future, they need to be proper lean fighting machines, don't they?
Yeah,
really?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you just didn't get that aspect of it at all in the visual representation.
No, it was very odd casting. It doesn't really, it's an actor playing a part.
And in the end, her part reminded me of that, the only female part in Victory of the Daleks, where the girl gets one line at the start and then one more line at the end of the episode, and you're supposed to feel sorry for her, even though you've not been given anything of her character. And then here we have, in Sleep No More, this transgender character, and as she sacrifices herself, you're supposed to feel sorry that she's sacrificing herself and, have an emotional connection with her that the script and the direction hasn't really earned.
No, this again, just to me, again, is another pointer as to why this maybe should have been a two-parter.
Or just fewer ideas, better developed.
The other thing that's odd for me to notice in this episode, because every time I do one of these sections of the podcast, everyone always mentions the music to me. And I've got to confess, I've not been really noticing the music this series. And there's a few points in this episode. There was one point where I was just sat there watching it and thinking, hang on, is there no music on this? A lot of it was very silent, and I actually thought that putting music on might have been...
Was there music then? Because I've only watched it once so far.
It's very subtle. I've been really impressed with the sound design this whole series, because I've got me four speakers in the corners of my room and my bass woofer. And in a few episodes, I've literally jumped because I thought there was something going on behind me, and it wasn't. The sound mix is great on the sound effects. But the music, I've not realised. But this episode, yes, there was music in it, but it was really, really subtle. It was sort of like you might get, the sound of a cello gradually getting louder to just give a bit of a feeling of suspense, or you might get some rhythmic bits,
Right.
But I think it could really have worked with none, because wasn't the Blair Witch famously had no soundtrack yet? They released a soundtrack CD, I believe.
Oh, did they?
Oh, yeah, there was a soundtrack CD of music inspired by Blair Witch.
Oh, what a ridiculous thing. Mind you, I've seen that done with other films. Music inspired by the film.
Yeah, because that's how they managed to... If a film's got a really popular soundtrack, they'll do a follow-up and they'll tenuously find songs inspired by,
Yeah, very dodgy. Yes, I think it could have worked entirely without music. But then, it's all about the oral landscape.
And I know that you had some interesting opinions on Rhys Shearsmith building up to this episode when you've talked about, what's going to be coming up in the series and your various columns and podcastings.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think he was used well, Rhys?
It was better than I was expecting him to be, but he doesn't convince me.
No.
No, not really. I mean, he was okay. I think if he'd have put a different actor in that part, I think they could have done a better job. But I think he did a reasonable enough job. Mm. Yeah, I don't think he was the problem with the episode.
No, I mean, I do think it was a brave and a good idea to do the episode. I thought it was a good idea. I'll tell you what came back in my head, though, every time I read about they were doing this found footage one.
Yeah.
This often happens when I see what's happening with Matt Gaetz's episode. I remember rumours about episodes that didn't happen. And I think it was back in 2006, a rumour went round that one of the episodes of David Tennant's first series would be a crossover with Time Team. And Tony Robinson and the team would be unearthing bits at an archaeological dig, which would gradually piece together a story happening in the past with the Doctor involved in it.
Oh, really? I've never heard that.
heard that rumour and thought, I always wanted them to do that episode. I think it's because they'd gone, you know, they'd done the Trinity and Susanna thing and the Big Brother thing. So I think somebody somewhere had decided, oh, well, there's always going to be some kind of link into popular culture and current TV. So I think that's maybe why the theory came about. But it always struck me as, actually, that sounds a real good story. I'd quite like that one.
Well, it would have made an interesting, or basically they could have the time team pulling out bits from an archaeological dig. And lo and behold, they build a spaceship, and that's when the Doctor turns up. Could be the Doctor Light episode.
It certainly could. Now, while we're talking about not only iconic cultural fantastic bits of TV and the past, wouldn't it be great? I mean, why doesn't someone put an anthology book together where great speakers and thinkers about things such as cult TV put their essays together in a book, it's bound together and published and sold for charity? Wouldn't it be wonderful if that happened, Jer?
Well, it would be a great idea. And when somebody comes up with that idea, I'm sure it will prove to be very popular.
Oh. Until then.
Until then, I've just got a book out. It's called You and Who Else? And, well, basically, it's like the other You and Who books that I've been doing for the past several years. I've previously been about Doctor Who. This one is about all of British telefantasy. So it starts with Quatermass back in 1953, goes right up to Jonathan Strange earlier this year. Mm-hmm. And the sort of concept behind it is that people are talking about watching the telly rather than necessarily talking about the television they're watching. So, and that's sort of open to interpretation, however the authors of these particular essays want to. So some of them will write something that's more akin to a review, and some of them would just write something about their life and how they watched television when they were a kid or something that barely relates to the subject at all. But there's a nice balance there between, you know, the people who are watching and the programs that they're watching. So basically, there's about 175 essays about 150 different television series or so. And the whole thing's like a big nostalgia fest, as well as a history of the country and the way the country's interacted with television over the past 60 years. And I can, you know, I'm quite happy to say what a brilliant book it is, because, you know, I didn't write it. Somebody, you know, lots of other different people wrote it.
Yeah, lots of people, including many of the presenters on the Doctor Who review show. I've contributed. It's marvellous fun doing that and the previous You and Who books. They're really good books. And they're doing a good thing, aren't they? Because, last week it was Children in Need, wasn't it? And the You and Who books, you put up what they'd actually raised, so because that went to Children in Need, which was quite over £1,000, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but they're nice, hefty books, which is what I like about them. They're good reads.
Oh, this one's very hefty, nearly.
This one is a stunning Christmas present for the geek, popular culturist, historian in your life.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, because I'm not being ungrateful to people, but people, you know, I get several packs of Doctor Who top trumps. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. People say, oh, you like Doctor Who and games, don't you? Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, thought it was a bit different and no one else would get you it. Thanks, cheers.
They won't now, they've heard this.
I'll put it over here with the others. But no, this one is special. It's a special book. It's at number one on the Amazon charts as we speak, JR.
Oh, yes, it was indeed, yes.
And the money is, again, for charity, isn't it?
Terence Higgins Trust this time, because Terence Higgins Trust... Well, you know, my feeling about charity anyway is that, you know, in the socialist society that we basically live in this country, since, you know, the National Health Service and all that was set up 100 years ago, we shouldn't really need charities anymore, but we do.
Absolutely.
And the thing about Terence Higgins Trust is, back in the 1980s, there was an awful lot of publicity about AIDS, HIV. And, you know, during the 1990s, all these charities that looked after people with these conditions were receiving lots of donations. But I think in the last 15 years, the amount of publicity this kind of thing gets has gone down at quite an alarming rate. even though the amount of people still suffering this and still need looking after is obviously not diminishing with anything like the same kind of volume. So something like the Terence Higgins Trust, I think it's very important that we still, you know, still support those charities. And of course, Russell T. Davis chose the Terence Higgins Trust when he was on Toby Haydock's Who's Round podcast. So Terence Higgins Trust is kind of Russell T. Davis' charity of choice. And since I launched this book on the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of Rose, you know, I launched the process for the book. Right. So since I launched the process then, it seemed only fitting, only appropriate that it should be for the Terence Higgins Trust this time.
Fantastic. So there'll be a link up to go buy the book. It's going to be a fantastic Christmas present, and it helps people, and it'll make people happy. This book couldn't be better.
Oh, and there's just so much great writing in there, and so many things. It's one of those books where if there's something you don't know that's in the book, you'll be straight on the internet, probably buying it, actually. And if the things you do know, then the way people have written about them will trigger all sorts of memories and nostalgia. It's just one of those books that I think provides a kind of experience that you wouldn't normally get with some kind of review guide or something like that. And you wrote about Spaced.
I did, yes. So I should be getting a thank you from Simon Pegg for the sales of Spaced DVDs going up, perhaps.
Yeah.
But you never know. Yes, I did write about Spaced. And, well, you know, I think I say it's sci-fi and cult, but it's not, is there? Because there's all sorts in there that, you know, that there can be tiny, tenuous links. But actually, when you think about it, they're not that tenuous, are they?
Well, there's...
the Wombles, haven't they?
I said at the start that it was telefantasy, and that if something came up that somebody wanted to write about that, you know, just wasn't in the regular idea of what fantasy was at all, if they could persuade me, they could write about it. And somebody got in touch. Daniel Greensmith, I think he was called. 175 names, you know, you've started to keep on top of all of them. And said, I want to write about Top Gear. And I said, well, if you can persuade me it's fantasy, then you can write about Top Gear. And he said, isn't it every guy's fantasy to have the cars that they have on Top Gear? And I said, you're in.
So we've got Top Gear in there. There's the Wombles, Doctor Who, of course. There's
Blue Peter.
The Clangers, Blue Peter. Yeah. Goodies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the goodies.
Good. Yeah, because, yeah, that was in the news this week. Bill Oddie's annoyed, isn't he? Because they're not in the BBC shop. And they've been shunned again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they've been snubbed and not put on the online BBC store.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe they will get put on later. These things tend to go...
Well, that's what the BBC said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about launching something like that is you have to sort out the rights issues for anything that's not previously been in the public domain.
That's right.
So I can imagine that sorting all that out was one hell of a nightmare. And so if there are things that aren't on there yet, chances are there will be once it's all sorted out.
If only you would have been available to calm down Bill Oddie's latest rant, and he would have been very grateful, I'm sure.
He's one of those people who loves to be angry, though, isn't he?
Oh, he is, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. I'm glad we got to promote the book, because we are all in it here, and we love it, and it's going to be our bestseller for Christmas. So get it in your stockings, ladies and gents. And JR, it's been an honour to have you on talking about Doctor Who, which is... I love hearing you talk about Doctor Who, so it's been great to chat to you about it.
Well, it's been an honour to be on Who Wars, Rev. Doctor Who Review Show.
Oof, blimey, that should be in the...
that was just my little joke.
A bit retro, isn't it? I've heard you mention Who Wars on the Blue Box podcast. I think, oh, should I write in and tell them off? You're still fine, as if you Google Who Was anyway, I think. Rob still hasn't finished tweaking the wiring.
Oh, I should imagine so, yeah.
Excellent. Right, well, thank you very much for that, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the series. And good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Ring with a friend, I said
you called Dr. Robert. Hey there, everyone. Dr. Robert here with the test results for both Face the Raven and Sleep No More. Take a seat. I'm going to cram both into one consultation. First up, let's talk about the most recent episode, Face the Raven. I thought this had to be the coolest name for a Doctor Who episode, even before the series started, when the BBC officially announced all the names of the episodes. I said, that looks like an interesting one. because even back then it seemed to have a death sort of vibe going on, something dark going on. I mean, Face the Raven, that sounds pretty dark, pretty cool. And, you know, it delivered. It was an interesting episode. Once again, we had Maisie Williams, a shoulder, up to something that then gets out of control. And you have to wonder how many times this happens for her over the years. I mean, she's lived for an awfully long time. You know, does this happen often, or is it just when the doctor comes by? That would be quite maddening, wouldn't it? You go hundreds of years doing good works, saving people, setting up this Diagon Alley from Harry Potter, and next thing the doctor appears and everything goes horribly wrong again. But I digress. As a farewell episode for Clara, I've got to say it felt a little undercooked in some ways. And, you know, that is to say, I liked the premise, Clara trying to be the doctor once again and finally getting herself into something that she couldn't get out of. And the moment when her life is taken, the silent scream she gives, and the fact we see it, you know, repeated a couple of times. And before that, her steadfastness and her determination to go well, you know, that was all very, very good. But, you know, after everything she's been and done in the series, it still felt a little light on. I guess, how do you write out a character like that? And maybe that highlights the fact that she's a companion they let go on for a little too long in the series. She certainly should have left last year. It was kind of crazy, I think, to let the character have another year when she was being set up to go last year. And we could have had a different companion with Capaldi this time around, which would have been interesting and so on. But you know what? Although I've said all of that, I did really loathe where they took Clara in the last series and the way she behaved. So although I think she should have gone last year, at least this year gave us, you know, a chance to say goodbye to a character we were enjoying again. And when I say we, I mean myself and people out there who felt similarly that, you know, last series she was just a bit unlikable, whereas this series, some of us warmed to her again. Of course, there are people out there who have liked Clara all along, and bully for you. But from what I can see, however, this actually wasn't the end for Clara. I've got a feeling she'll pop up in both of the upcoming episodes, or at least one of them, likely as some sort of memory or a ghost or something like that, which in some ways does lessen the blow of this episode. You know, it's like when I guess they killed off Buffy and we were all sad and then she came back to life. But, you know, that's modern TV. You know, the days of someone like Adric getting blown up and never seen again until a tiny, tiny cameo a couple of seasons later. Those days are long gone. You know, people don't really stay dead, even if they are really dead. And I do think Clara is really dead. I do think if we see her again in the next couple of episodes, it will be, as I say, as a ghost or a memory of something that had happened in the past or something like that. Anyway, I've got to cut to the next episode, or the previous episode, I should say. So let me just say, all up, a solid 8 out of 10 for Face the Raven, another winner for me from this series. I enjoyed it. It was great. And now, a word on Sleep No More. Mark Gatiss is a Doctor Who writer I have a real love-hate relationship with, and I know a lot of people do feel the same. He's written some episodes I adore. He's also written some episodes I really hate. And, you know, on balance, I know he's just a big Who geek at heart and wants to have, you know, big-time fun writing the show, and I can't say a bad thing about that. He's, in short, a guy I'd like to have a beer or two with. You know, I don't dislike the guy at all. And so, as in past series, I went into this one thinking, what's it going to be, the Gat I like or the Gat I hate? And make no mistake, I always hope it's the former. I never, ever wish a Doctor Who episode is going to be bad or something I dislike. But in this episode's case, I've got to say, it fell somewhere between the two. Very interesting. I mean, I loved the found footage idea, even if it did cheat a bit with the explanation that Rasmussen had been editing it a bit and putting it together to explain why it was presented in the way that it was. And my wife commented that it felt a bit like a video game. And while I've seen some other people say it was like an FPS game or a first-person shooter game, she meant more in the RPG sense, such as games like Mass Effect. And I have to agree with her. It felt like that to me too at times. It felt like when you're playing an RPG and people are walking up and talking to each other and you're observing and, you know, maybe making your own comments. And I thought that was pretty cool. I also love the way the cast of the rescue mission was sort of Indian and Japanese or had mixed backgrounds. You know, as the Doctor explained, there'd been some sort of catastrophe where India and Japan had merged in terms of their land masses. And it reminded me in some ways of Firefly, where you're watching this big futuristic sci-fi, which had a heavy Chinese vibe. You know, the cast would often break into Mandarin at times. And I love seeing futures where different cultures have sort of risen up to become the new superpower, or are at least, you know, involved in ways that you might not be expecting. And, you know, this sort of Indian-Japanese mix was really kind of cool. But it started to fall down a bit from there, for me at least. I wasn't overly excited by the idea of, you know, sleep in the corner of your eye being turned into this life form that wants to eat you. I mean, I get the angle it was going for, something that you can trace right back to Mary Shelley. And, you know, doesn't Mark Gatiss like, you know, gothic sort of horror? So you think about Mary Shelley, you think about technology creating abominations, you think of Frankenstein, you think of things like that. But it did sort of fall over into the silly camp rather than the wow sort of camp. It just was just a bit too silly to be cool, to be scary. I wanted to really, really like it, trust me on that, but I kept thinking, oh, really? Really? And then we had the whole idea that it was all a ruse and we'd just been watching The Ring. I mean, watching Sleep No More. And, you know, that was the real infection, you know, watching the video. And that was just a little too, oh, I don't know, I don't want to use the word lazy, I really don't, but it just didn't sit well with me. It just didn't feel like a creative ending. It did feel way too much like The Ring. If you've not seen The Ring, go out and watch it. It's quite good. I'm also slightly horrified, I've got to say, at the fact Stephen Moffat wants to see a sequel to this episode too. Out of all the episodes so far, he wants a sequel from this one. Ugh. All up, this will surprise you all, it's a 6 out of 10 for me. This is the only episode out of the first 10 this series that I've scored below an 8. I wasn't a fan. And I would love to have been a fan of it. I think it does have some great redeeming features. I did enjoy parts of it. But this was a 6 out of 10. First time this series. Anyway, that's it from me. I'll see you in a couple of weeks and we'll be talking something very, very cool, I'm sure. Because these next two episodes look very, very special. See you then. Ring with a friend, I said you called up a robber.
Hi, it's Al, and I'm here with...
me.
Him. So, we've just finished watching Sleep No More. And where should we start?
Well, actually, how late on was that one? Like, at night?
How late? It was the same time. It was 8:10 until 9.
Do you think that the name was, you know...
I think that what we saw there was Mark Gatiss attempting to write a Stephen Moffat-esque script. And what he actually produced was something that had the same problems almost exactly as Nightmare in Silver, in that a lot of that would have looked great on paper but just didn't work, because with the exception of Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman, the performances weren't up to the script. Well, that might be a directing issue. Okay, right, so the found footage conceit.
Oh, it wasn't it. Let's just no. Couldn't decide whether it wants to be found footage or not, and I feel like it ended halfway through.
Well, yeah, I think that's because it set up things to come, isn't it? It's the first part in the conclusion. In the Dust Saga, yeah, okay. I thought that... Right, okay. Reese Shearsmith brought his other performance to it, of the two that he usually delivers, with the exception of... the third one that he managed to get out in...
I get it, you don't like him, you don't like Mark Gatiss.
It's not that I don't like them, it's just I think that their best work is an awful long time behind them, and that there's nothing actually very new taking place with what they do. And as far as pastiches go, which is what we usually see with Mark Gatiss, that one referenced Flesh and Stone, The Invisible Enemy, Predator, Alien, Judge Dredd, Sandman, I can tell you which issue if you like, Oliver, Journey to the Centre of the TARDIS, Spider-Man 3, Event Horizon, Aliens, Peep Show, Prometheus, Macbeth, Sunshine 42, Monty Python, Doom, Quake, Pertwee Era Doctor Who, Ring, The Space Pirates, a little bit of Inception, and involved Mark Gatiss taking the mick out of Terry Nation whilst at the same time proving he is no Stephen Moffat, because the author's voice throughout that was a bit too loud and it was far too smug. It's not a found footage film either.
Spider-Man 3?
Spider-Man 3, yeah, it's got Sandman in it, and the similar effects, it all fall apart.
Right. Was that really a reference?
Well, yeah, probably, because the way Rasmussen fell apart at the end was very reminiscent of the way that the Sandman falls apart in Spider-Man 3. It's also, oddly enough, it's not the first found footage Doctor Who episode. It's the first one that's canon. Because do you remember back to when we had the flurry of value-added material before Day of the Doctor?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, we also had one
The intro bit was reminiscent of that, very.
Yeah, it's a cutscene. It comes across more like Peep Show than an actual found footage film, because it's not found footage.
But it wasn't found footage. It kept cutting to bits that shouldn't have been recorded, and perspectives that couldn't have been recorded, and it was all edited together, which is... What?
The only way they're going to get away with that is if it turns out, you know, like, we're still inside someone's dream.
Well, we are, aren't we? We're still inside Clara's dream.
Mm.
But that's what I mean by it ended halfway through. That was never resolved.
Well, I think that's the start of Clara's doom. She's gradually going to turn into a great big pile of walking snot. Oh, which is Swamp Thing, so we can have that one too. Yeah, okay, yeah. I thought Peter Capaldi was really good. We've got to come up with something positive we can say about it. Was it scary?
I feel like it would have been better had we not seen them, because they were essentially giant humanoid things that were just mouths all the way down. And I've seen that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was in Nemesis the Warlock, actually. There was one of those back in around about 1980?
Yeah, there's an enemy in Digital Devil Saga 2 that looks like them as well.
Uh-huh.
But it's orange and has teeth in the mouth.
It just all felt like... There was nothing new there. There was nothing we hadn't seen before. It wasn't brave. It wasn't adventurous. It wasn't challenging. It was just... I don't know.
It was weird.
Yeah. I thought Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman performed really well, and I think that the supporting cast did the best that they could. But that it just goes to show why we don't really get found footage stuff on TV.
Well, it wasn't found footage. This is the thing. I think it would have been really good as found footage, because you wouldn't have seen the Dust Snot monsters.
Mm. Which is a straight lift. Well, near enough, it's a straight lift from Sunshine. Oh, I don't know.
I never did finish Sunshine.
No. Right, okay. Well, so on that bombshell...
Well, I don't know. Do you want to talk about next week's...
Face the Raven.
Is that what it's called?
Well, it's all about facing ravens, isn't it? And I don't...
Well, I thought it was going to be... I've been trying to think of a pun involving Edgar Allan Poe and dust, but I just can't do it.
Really? Yeah. Oh, well, no. I mean, you've got I Will Show You Fear in a Handful of Dust, which was the advertising for the first run of Sandman when it was first coming out as a comic, but that's not from Poe, no. Which is a shame.
No, I've just been trying to think of a pawn, if you will. No, but I can't.
All right, then. Do you want to make a noise with rain? Or just some dust? And on that bombshell. Hi, it's Al, and I'm here with...
The me.
Hiya.
How long can I do that before it starts being funny?
I don't think it'll ever stop being
funny. It has to start being funny first.
Yes, but, well, yeah, this is true. Okay, so we've just seen Face the Raven.
Your notes are very sparse.
Well, they are. Do you know, I'm interested in your take on it. I found it really... I thought it was really good.
Yes.
Yeah.
It had a good effect.
Mm.
And once again, the speech. It tends to be the speeches
mm-hmm.
that make these episodes.
Yeah. It's kind of... A lot of what we've been predicting is there. You know, it's a three-parter to conclude the series. Ashildia kills Clara because she had to. I don't think we'll see Missy next week. I think she'll be back the week after that, because it's obviously been set up by Missy. The whole thing, you know, to get, obviously.
Yeah.
The weird thing is the TARDIS first landed in London in the same location that Danny Pink was killed, which I thought was an interesting nod, because it's actually in Cardiff. It's the back of the museum. Summer Stephen Moffat's voice was in that. There's a little bit of rewriting in it, I think. But I thought Sarah Dillard's script was really good. There's also...
It's a lot better than you thought it would be.
There's a lot, again, as we've had last week as well, there are an awful lot of Neil Gaiman references, amongst other things. I mean, you've also got the Harry Potter thing, you know, like the city that's next to us that we don't see.
Yeah.
But there's two different Neil Gaiman...
It was initially just a sad little, like, alleyway. That was it. That's all that they hid.
It was all, yeah. But there's a Neil Gaiman story, a Sandman story, that's about a bloke that wanders down a street and gets lost, and it's a street he's never seen before, and he gets lost in the dreams of the city. So that was one. There's also Neverwhere, which is all about London above and London below, which is the London that we don't get to see, because you haven't seen that one. And there were kind of similarities with that, you know. But also, there were a couple of... There was a similar bit to Clive Barker's Nightbreed and Night of the Demon, with the idea that once you get a curse, you can't pass it on. That was all right. Because they couldn't go full Adric anymore, so, you know, Clara has to... You know, although the death is basically the same as Adric's.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if this is the same sort of effect that Adric's death would have had on the audiences back then.
Well, the thing is, back then, we didn't know it was going to happen, and we got a silent credit sequence at the end, and it was a shock, because the Doctor just couldn't save him, and then he just died. And he faced the Raven by himself, as it were, or faced the Earth, as it came up to meet him. He didn't.
I wonder if it'll be friends with me.
I wonder if it'll be friends with me. Yeah. He didn't get an 8-minute speech, and then a slow motion walk out.
The slow motion walk was...
It was really funny.
Yeah, it was not necessary, but the speech was good.
Yeah, the speech was really good.
The fact that her eyes, she wasn't crying, but her eyes were really shiny,
mm-hmm,
worked as well.
I think Jenna Coleman's performance was brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was, and Peter Capaldi was fantastic in that one.
He always is.
I'm really looking forward to next week's. And then I'm looking forward to the conclusion of this. I think
the conclusion's terrible.
I don't think it will be. Well, it's going to be Time War, isn't it? It's going to turn out to have been Missy and the Daleks. Or Missy, at least. And then, you know, it's going to be Time War, I reckon. Conclusion, to bring it back for the full 10 years. This time as well, I thought that there was a definite... it was a bit rushed, killing her off, you know, by having her hanging out of the TARDIS and doing all the things, because she's become more of a thrill seeker. This Clara, this is she,
yes,
yeah.
Of all the characters to bring back, why Rixie?
It was a bit random. It was a little bit random. But I guess
he had to bring someone back.
He was very good as well, actually.
Before, yeah,
you know, it was good.
Maybe that's why they brought him back.
I thought the chap who with the Harry Potter glasses wasn't terrific, but other than that, it was good. And Maisie Williams was good as well, very good as she'll do. There's a bit in Sandman as well, where a character called Thessaly saves another character. I think it's Leta Hall, and it's a similar kind of thing. And then you get the warning that, you know, I might have saved you, but you better run. You know, it's a kind of like that. I'm not going to forgive you for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was competent. It was nicely done. The music was... Some of the music was really good, but we're a long way on from Doomsday, which was shocking. It was just...
Literally.
Well, Doomsday was a very original and quite gutsy way of doing the music to accompany the scene. That
I thought you hated Doomsday.
No, Doomsday was great. The music was brilliant. You know, when Rose gets stuck beyond the wall and everything, and you've got the single bass guitar going, and then it builds up into a thing and it runs over minutes, whereas that was just... It's just more orchestra again.
Yeah.
You know.
It wasn't bad in that episode, though. It wasn't as bad as... You know, it wasn't dum-da-dum-dum, worry, dum-da-dum-dum-dum. It wasn't that.
No, it wasn't. Right, and I think probably the term retcons, I don't know, I reckon that might have been suggested by Stephen Moffat, but other than that, I think, yeah, I thought that was pretty good, very good, strong ending. But then it's been building to this.
Mm.
You know, this series has been building to it.
With such classics as the Zygon invasion.
Yeah, grief, yeah. And Sleep
Before
No
the
More.
Flood.
That was, Before the Flood was alright, Under the Lake was brilliant.
Sleep No More. Yeah, Sleep No More was best of the series. 10 out of 10.
Anyway, go on, make some more dust noises then.
No, we've got to make raven noises.
We've got to make a raven noise. And on that bombshell.
You've got to make one too.
That was more like a...
What's the matter?
I'm sad.
Why are you sad?
Because I watched Doctor Who.
I watched Doctor Who too.
Clara died in front of me.
Oh, Poppet, are you okay?
Are they cheering up?
Well, let's talk quirky.
Okay. Is there something is there something fun on your list that will lift my spirits?
I'm going to be lifted. In Sleep No More, we can talk Geordie Pet.
Oh, hey, man.
I was having the time of my life because I only know two words in Geordie.
Yes,
that weetabix and conjunctivitis.
Oh, conjunctivitis, right? I've got another good one for you.
Now I can add meteorite strike.
I've got two more for you.
Yes,
I've got two more for you. Right, this one goes back to the days of film photography, though, so it's probably really irrelevant to some of the listeners. But Kula Kula Gold.
Yes,
and for the motorcyclists among us, you could ride a Kawasaki.
Yes, that's a good one. I loved her. I thought she was a really good character, the Geordie. Just because she kept calling everybody Pet.
And it's a good time to mention Bagger Grove.
Yes, bit of Anton Deck.
Yeah, oh yeah, PJ and Duncan as was. And wasn't it sad when he got blinded by a paintball?
Never got over that.
No, no, sad days. See, you brought it down again now.
Oh yeah, sorry. Oh,
what's next? What else?
Well, I haven't really got much on my list this week, which is mainly because I just got totally lost in it in both episodes.
Oh, I'm surprised there's one thing you haven't written down.
Oh, well, which one?
For Face the Raven, have you not written anywhere on your piece of paper Diagon Alley?
No, I've written York.
The shambles, yeah.
Yeah, look like the shambles.
I thought it was going back to when Voldemort was in the Dalek episode. I thought there was, like, you know, big crossovers.
Yeah. Yet another film reference, Harry Potter.
Yeah, ping.
I watched it with subtitles again, and they spelled out the sound of the TARDIS, and this time I wrote it down.
Okay, go on.
V-W-O-R-P.
V-W-O-R-P, warp, as it is in the comics.
Brilliant. That's
a lovely bit of continuity, linking the comic book worlds together. I'd like to ask Al Noe, does that mean that the comics are canon? Hmm? Yeah, write in. Well, what happened at my house was a bit annoying because sometimes my telly decides to switch audio description on without me asking it to. And it hadn't been on because I watched Strictly before it and nothing had happened. You know, I stood up, turned the lights out to make it a bit dark and moody, got a bottle of Plonk, and all of a sudden a deep voice goes, "The phone is ringing on the TARDIS console." I've got to switch it off.
You should record a full episode of that and see if people can guess which one it is.
Oh, that'd be good, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Come on then, what else we got?
Oh, did you like Gagan Rashomon?
Gagan Rashomon?
Rashomon, that was, what's his face in Sleep No More, our man from Hulk.
Reese?
Reese J. Smith. He was great, wasn't he?
Well, it always lights up my life when League of Gentlemen are on telly, and I do like Reese J. Smith, I'm that guest, but I don't think they're the greatest actors on the planet, but I think that's why I like them, because you know what you're getting, and it's cosy. Oh.
Yeah, and he does often play similar characters, doesn't he?
Yeah, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
It went in a different way to what I thought it was, that one. I thought it was going to turn out that they were all asleep, or, you know, like in Red Dwarf, where it turned out they were all about 5 years' worth of virtual reality headsets on.
That's right, yeah.
A bit like that, where it turned out it was all a big dream. Like the episode in Neighbours when Bouncer went to sleep.
Have you seen the episodes of Neighbours that were only on the internet when all the dead characters came back as zombies?
No.
I don't know what it was for. It was some kind of anniversary special or something. Because Harold came. Well, I can't remember. Is Harold alive or dead now? I can't remember. He was in it, but I don't think he was a zombie.
Did die. He's back now.
No, his son was in it as a zombie. That's right.
Wasn't his son Jason Donovan?
No. Jason Donovan was, yeah, that... was Manor's stepson.
Yeah, that's
Jason,
it, yeah.
I don't think Jason Donovan's not dead, is he?
No, I'm going to go see him in concert.
Well, there you go. He's not dead, Daisy. He must be alive. Well. So, right, okay. What else did we notice then? Well, now then. I've got to be very careful how far we go with this, but we've got to... Right, okay. Now, this bit deserves a jingle, because I don't know if we'll be able to do it again, but I'd just like to sing a jingle. Clara's Fashions!
Yeah.
When she's hanging out the TARDIS over London, and they dragged her back in that tight jumper, you could see nipple. obviously.
Just the shape of a nipple.
I wish I had audio description on that.
Yes.
Clara makes a point. She looked good in that jumper, and I was thinking, it's nice that they don't have to be scantily clad, these Doctor Who bits.
Yes.
To look amazing.
I was a bit scantily clad, wasn't she?
It was.
Upon, she always wore short skirts.
I'm dressed as a policewoman.
Yeah, we can forgive Amy.
I've got that toy on my bed. On the
right. Yeah. That was a different story altogether.
Yes, it is. Anyway.
A shielder.
Yes.
She's, I can't work her out. Because she's like a bit bad, but then she has compassion all the time when she sees things that are sad.
Maybe she forgets whether she's bad or good because she has to write it down, doesn't she?
Yes.
Do you think they've rushed the character a bit?
Maybe. I'd like to see more of her. I'd
like to have seen a bit more.
Because there's all these sort of gaps, like centuries, where I want to know what she's been doing in that time.
I'd like to read her diaries.
Yes, that'd be a whole new series.
Do you think she'll come back?
The Diary of a Shielder. Yeah, she'll be back.
Yeah.
She just has to be a little bit tentative now, because the Doctor is mad.
Whoa, God, he goes crazy, doesn't he?
Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah. I think this is the last bit I'll be speaking in this podcast, so I better mention a couple of other things that crossed my mind. I don't know if it's quirky, but it's a good reference. It's quite interesting. Well, I think it is. So it reminded me a lot of a Neil Gaiman TV series that was called Neverwhere. It was set on the London Underground, sort of like a underneath the Underground, sort of like a mystery other London that was through like a little narrow gap like this. And it reminded me a lot of that. Now, on the original TV series, which I think was from about 1990, there is an angel in it, and the angel is played by Peter Capaldi.
No way!
And then they made a radio version of it about 3 years ago, and the angel was played by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Ooh!
And I believe they're making another version of it for telly, because it's quite a good story. But yeah.
That reminded me
of that, and of course Neil Gaiman's written for the series, and then it made me wonder, well, that's weird, isn't it? Because Neil Gaiman could have written an episode like this setting.
Like a
Trap Street.
I like Trap Street.
Yeah, it's clever.
We do have to maybe discuss Clara at some point, even though you seem happy and all.
I mean, I might have a neck tattoo as a tribute with the numbers. Well. Yes, Clara. Well, I mean, in fairness, I knew she was going to go this series, and I had read that she was going to die. I had read that and I tried to ignore it. I didn't know when it was going to happen, and I'd like to just tell Peter Capaldi off for doing on the Graham Norton show the night before. He said, "Oh yeah, it's Clara's last episode, and it's really sad."
Oh no!
Oh my God! I wish I hadn't have stayed up and watched this.
That's annoying, because it was spoiled for me as well, because I didn't watch it straight away last night. I watched it this morning, and I saw on Twitter someone had put what happened. I thought, for God's sake, why can't everyone just shut up? Oh. But it turns out that the full country is.
That's the curse of Graham Norton, which, because we've got to mention. Now, do you remember in the first episode, way back in 2005, Rose, I think Graham Norton was presenting a live TV show that went on after it, which was, it was like a dance program, like a disco competition.
Yeah.
And they faded up the live studio microphone during a bit in the first episode of Doctor Who. So you got Graham Norton going, "Oh, let's have a big cheer," and the audience going, "Woo!" And, you know. And then, in the episode with the Matt Smith episode of The Weeping Angels, right at the end, the cartoon Graham Norton walks across the screen saying,
how would you solve a like a problem like Maria on next? And then walked off, writing a real movie speech by Matt Smith.
Graham Norton is
sort of like a guest star three times now.
I like Graham, though.
I know, you do like Graham, yes, but he's a bit tricky when it comes to Doctor Who, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I'm a bit torn now.
But, right, just to make me feel better, do you think she is dead?
Well, I'm glad you said that. I don't know. It was a bit like a Dementor, wasn't it? She needed a Patronus to get...
Is that another Harry Potter reference again in this series? I bet there's loads we've missed.
Yeah, I do think she's dead.
I just realised, you know what else we've missed, don't you?
What?
When the glasses broke and you said it was like Jack Duckworth. No, we could have done a spell, couldn't we?
Oh, yeah. What's that called? Repairer something.
Oculus
repairer something.
Well, between us, we can mend glasses. Oh, that's good.
That make things levitate.
Yeah, well.
What was that, Clara? Yeah. I was mad with her. I just thought, you stupid cow. Because... if she'd have just left it, it would have been fine. Because the Shield was going to get rid of the tattoo on what's-his-face's neck. Yeah. Local knowledge. Local knowledge's neck. And it would have been fine, but she got thinking too clever, and I was mad with her.
Well, what should we sing? Last time a companion died in Doctor Who, in the 80s, when Adric died, it was like, they had no music over the closing credits. And he used to wear, like, a sheriff's badge for counting.
So, Neighbours... when Todd died, or when anyone died in Neighbours, they used to play the theme tune, but slowed down.
Oh, on the piano, right. We'll play out with that then, but should we sing the Neighbours theme tune slowly then, to blend into it?
Yes.
And solemnly. Neighbours, everybody Neighbours.
Hello, it's Ian here, and I just wanted to raise a point of order with everyone, because what we've just seen at the end of Face the Raven is one of the most significant things that's ever happened to the Doctor, and I don't think it's necessarily getting enough attention. But the Doctor's best friend, Clara, has died. Now, companions come and go, and they come and go fairly regularly, every 1, 2, or 3 years, in a kind of revolving door policy. When I started watching the show way back when, in the sort of 17th century, I can remember Romana leaving. I couldn't remember much about it. I mean, I could remember visually the image of her and K-9 walking into some kind of white space, but I remember Adric. You know, I was there for Adric. That was a water cooler moment at the creche the next day. I remember Tegan's leavings, Nyssa going. Perry I missed. Perry was a companion leaving that I missed because I was at a birthday party and everybody there wanted to watch the A-Team. But I was going, no, it's Doctor Who. Doctor Who's on now. It's episode 8 of The Trial of a Time Lord. Well, please. But they said, no, we all want to watch the A-Team, for we are bigger than you and slightly foolish. So I, luckily, this party was happening about, let's say a 30-second run from my own house. So I ran back to watch Doctor Who. And my dad was appalled at my bad manners for temporarily deserting a birthday party to watch Doctor Who, so he promptly stopped videoing it and wouldn't let me watch it, which is a shame because Perry was responsible for many of my earliest awakenings, although she wasn't in The Awakening. Don't get confused, don't get sidetracked. Mel left, that didn't I didn't shed too many tears when that happened. Ace never got to leave, of course. Ace just left with the Seventh Doctor at the end of Survival. Everyone will always say that the high watermark of emotional agony at the leaving of a companion would be Rose Tyler with the Doctor on Blythe Droog Bay saying one final romantic farewell. And yes, I can remember that was fairly... fairly emotional, but it was 10 years ago. We were all new to this game of being manipulated by Russell T. Davis and Mr. Gold, who I'm sure has been mentioned before in this episode. So, you know, Martha, I don't think a lot of people really felt emotionally invested with the character of Martha. A lot of people cried at what happened to Donna. But again, for me, because it was Catherine Tate, it was never... I could never quite believe in the character because it was Catherine Tate. So I kind of sidestepped that one. And Amy and Rory, it's kind of... I want to say it's kind of an accepted wisdom in fandom, but it's not, because the fandom I listen to is people like me. It's guys in their sort of, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s who have grown up with the show and who all kind of were at the same point in our emotional development, and we all feel the same way about things. So there are kind of teenagers out there who are still kind of probably bereft about Amy and Rory and probably did genuinely have an absolute meltdown. So I don't want to belittle anyone's emotions. But I think that the Doctor's emotions have been belittled, because it was all very well him standing there all dignified, doing amazing acting and sort of looking a bit wet of eye and gently kissing Clara's hand and watching her go to face the Raven. And yes, the Doctor was furious. He really wanted to do something terrible to Ashilda, and Clara talked him out of it and bravely walked outside and met her fate, and the Doctor sort of, you know, activated the teleport and went. But, and here's my problem with this, Clara is not just an ordinary companion. She's not someone the Doctor's been hanging out with for 3 years. The Doctor is 2000, and he spent about 1,000 years on Trenzalore, where he was protecting and defending the town of Christmas, and indeed the whole of Trenzalore, from the Daleks and all the baddies he's ever faced. During that time, Clara would pop in and out and was kind of his still de facto companion. Before that, he met her in his final incarnation, in a number of forms, obviously during the Snowman, during Asylum of the Daleks, but then the Bells of St. John. My fundamental point here is, if you think back to that and you think of everything that the Doctor has been through, he has known Clara for 1,000 years or so. About half of his life, he has known Clara. He's travelled with Clara. He's, you know, and I don't mean this in a romantic sense, but he has loved Clara. Now, I've just turned a significant number, and I'm trying to think of, you know, there are friends that I've known for approximately half of my life, and that's that. Well, I'm not going to tell you how old I am. It's rude to ask. But if anything happened to any of those people that I've known that long, I'd go crazy, and the Doctor would have gone crazy. He would not have been able to be talked out of it just by Clara asking him politely not to lose his rag. He would have gone crazy. He still might. I really hope that this is what's going to happen in episodes 11 and 12, that the Doctor, okay, he made a show of, you know, leaving in a dignified way, but I want him broiling with fury at what's happened, and I want him to be out of control. I want him to be both the Time Lord Victorious and the Valiard over this, because there is probably nothing that could ever affect the Doctor more. Let's look at it. He's destroyed his home planet. He's dealt with that. He's rescued it. Fine. He's been hurt, he's been lied to by the Master about where the Gallifrey is. He's obviously, you know, massively out on a limb psychologically with regard to that. But this thing, losing someone he's known for 1,000 years, this will hurt more than losing the Brigadier, I think. This will absolutely destroy that character. And it's got to happen. You've got to see that happen. Otherwise, for me, the whole thing just won't quite ring true. Because I couldn't bear it if our wonderful show about a face-changing, time-travelling wizard in a blue box that's bigger on the inside than the outside suddenly stopped being believable.
Hello, I'm Beth, and I'm here with Kevin Jordan again.
Hello.
We've just watched Face the Raven, and I'm going to ask Kev what you thought of it.
I enjoyed 95% of it, I would say. I actually felt it was a proper story with a beginning, a middle and an end for a change, and almost it felt like an old school Doctor episode that we saw a few years ago, rather than the convoluted things that are trying to say too much that they've done this season. We all knew Clara was going to die. We all knew that Ashilda was going to have something to do with it. I don't think I quite could have predicted how that was going to happen. I don't think I could have predicted what exactly would happen, and I certainly didn't predict the whole thing about the Doctor and the teleport bracelet and him being taken away and all that side of things. But no, I did. I really enjoyed it, which surprised me, because I must admit I went into it expecting not to.
I've got to say, I also went into it convinced I wasn't going to enjoy this episode. I don't think I enjoyed it as much as you did.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested to hear your breakdown of the 95 and 5%. But I did like it more than I expected. I thought there were some really interesting concepts in there, really interesting touches, even if I didn't think the story as a whole hung together perfectly. Like you said, I've been saying for weeks that Clara's going to die and it's going to be at Ashilda's hands. As soon as we saw Clara walk through the TARDIS and dust herself off, she was just seeping hubris from every pore. And I found that quite uncomfortable, actually. We've had, in the last few episodes particularly, Clara becoming more and more confident in her ability and more doctor-like, as a lot of us have been saying. And that is hubristic. And that was inevitably going to be her downfall. She's too confident in her own abilities.
Oh, she's far too cocky.
And that is indeed what brought her down. Because it was Ashilda who killed her, but never Ashilda's intention, and entirely her own, quite frankly, Clara's own fault.
And the thing is, even the Doctor had said, you know, partway through the episode, he'd noticed that there was a problem with her. You know, being too cocky and you know, loving the adventure and the thrill of it. She's become a bit of a thrill junkie, to be honest. And he said he'd noticed that too. I think he said it to Riggsy. But obviously, he's not done anything about it. He's just let it go and thinking, oh, you know, she'll work her way through it and it'll be okay. And it's come back and bitten him on the behind, to be perfectly honest, and shocked him. When I talk about 95% and 5%, the 95% I enjoyed was, I did enjoy the story about the hidden streets, even though it's blatantly ripped off Neverwhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even down to, you know, the idea of these streets are all these creatures that are hidden that normal people can't see.
We've had two stories on the trot now that are ripping off Gaiman, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, somebody's obviously a fan.
I don't think it's Stephen Moffat. No, it's not Stephen Moffat.
I don't have a problem with that because, you know, Neverwhere, the TV series of Neverwhere was a long time ago. Very few people would have seen it, although I know they're going to be making a new version. Mm. I thought that was great. I'm not entirely sold on Cybermen and Sontarans and other monsters coexisting happily just because there's a little light that sprays out above them and gets them all to be nice to each other.
Well, I don't think that that was the point. I think the whole... I think it was the enforcement of the law. I think it was the fear of the Raven that was forcing them to live peacefully rather than... I think that the... I really liked the Wormlight psychic field, which was more for the benefit of humans that stumbled across them than it was for the inhabitants, because presumably the inhabitants actually saw each other as they were. And you, because it's effectively psychic paper, but in light form. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I quite like that. That was one of the touches that I really liked.
What about the Cyberman that was in fear of his life?
Well, I think that's, he's, if you don't know how long he's been there. I mean, it's explained that that street has been existing as a sanctuary for all kinds of alien and futuristic life forms for over 100 years. Mm. So we know from past experience of Cybermen and Daleks that the cultural programming can actually be broken depending on circumstances. Uh-huh. I'd be very interested in who the woman he was trying to save was, because, you know, she may well not have been...
Not Cyberman.
Cyberman.
Yeah.
And what their relationship is. That's... I think it's very clever that they didn't explore that.
Mm.
And it was one of the things that I found intriguing.
And also, I think what I did quite like is that they didn't bother to say exactly what S.H.I.E.L.D. has been doing since we last saw her as a highway woman in the 1800s.
Mm.
She's obviously been doing something to do with this street, and that's become her project to save these creatures and protect them from the Doctor, effectively. But there wasn't a need to completely fill in on her backstory and things like that. They have left it open, presumably so she can come back at some future point. Maybe not with Peter Capaldi, but maybe with another Doctor they could bring her back.
I really hope not. I mean, I think, again, it's something we've touched on before on the After Nine segment. There is, because of Maisie Williams' character being someone that... probably isn't supposed to age very much there, and because she is currently played by a teenage actress, there will be in a few years a limit to the character's viability, unless something significant happens to her, because as I've said before, she's not indestructible. She can heal, sure, but she's not indestructible, and I'm wondering if actually she might be killed off in the storyline if the character doesn't just fade into obscurity after this.
You could be right.
We've discussed the fact that we both anticipated Clara's death. How did you feel it was handled?
Well, I thought it was really good up to a point. And I think we both know what that point is. The other thing I'll say is that I'm known in some circles, and certainly to you, as not being the greatest exponent of Murray Gold's music. I think some of the stuff he's done this year has been appalling.
I would say he's been quite restrained some of this year as well.
He has. And I actually did enjoy the music this year, and the whole piece leading up to Clara dying and her saying goodbye to the Doctor, I felt was lovely and very orchestral, and I had no problem with that at all. And then they just went and blew it. The music rose too loud. Clara's standing there, arms stretched like some kind of Christ-like figure, a mouth opening a silent scream. And I just wanted it to end.
Well, the whole third act of this was about Clara's martyrdom. She saved Riggsy and took his curse on herself. She martyred herself, perhaps somewhat unwittingly. And then when she realised there was no way out, she tried to be brave about it, which I thought was a little bit overblown, quite frankly. I don't know if I feel like it's the character or if it's Jenna Coleman who can't really carry off these sweeping grand speeches, especially after... I mean, it was a very brief, sharp fall from grace, very steep sheer drop, a fall from grace after weeks of hiking up this hubristic hill.
But I guess if it was going to happen, it was going to happen quickly and suddenly, and it was going to be her fault. And I think we'd all predicted that that's what was going to happen.
Mm.
And I've got no problem with that, and I've got no problem with the way that she died, and the way that Jenna Coleman acted up until the point she died. I just felt that they were trying to wring every last shred of emotion out of it. By all means, pull on the heartstrings, and I'm not unemotional to all of this. I don't mind it, but that whole last segment just before, as she was dying, if they'd just kept it quiet and let her just drop to the floor and that would have been it, I would have been much happier with that.
I felt some emotions. I don't know if they were the right emotions. because usually I watch the show alone, I can make whatever indignant noises I want. Today, I happen to be watching it with other people, so out of respect, I had to stifle laughter to the point that I nearly wet myself. I'm not as young as I used to be. A good sneeze will do it now.
Yeah, sure.
But I really found it comical. I'd been waiting for her to die for so long that I was either going to burst into hysterics or just start cheering. Not that we haven't seen her die before enough times, but and whether or not this time is finite, I know your theory is one that we were hoping to be able to discuss this week, but we might have to wait 2 weeks to discuss that one. And I do think that your theory is still in play and we'll have to wait until the finale. Next week, we know it's a Doctor-only episode. We don't know if it's just the one Doctor. We've had a lot of Doctors in flashback so far this season, so I still think everything's to play for.
Do you think they're going to do a Name of the Doctor and use existing clips of previous Doctors fed into the story?
I'm not entirely sure how it's going to play out. Based on the Next Time trailer, I've been trying quite hard to avoid spoilers.
Yeah, same here.
Even though I know that the synopses have been released by the BBC for the next two episodes. But based on the Next Time trailer, which I'd like to ask you about as well, it kind of reminds me of a Prisoner episode in which number six is psychologically tortured by Leo McKern and effectively driven mad. And I think the Doctor's going to be in isolation for, it could end up being a spanning thousands of years this next episode. I have an inkling, having avoided spoilers, that we're going to see Missy and the Daleks again from the first two-parter where we left her, and that in the final episode, Missy and Davros may well be responsible for teleporting him here, but for now he's going to be on his own. Whether he hallucinates other versions of himself or other versions of himself are involved, and we have yet another multi-doctor story like we did for the last anniversary, I don't know. But even if it is a doctor only story, I think there's certainly scope for David Tennant to come back, because we've seen so much of him.
I think he could be back. I know there are rumours, although I've not paid an awful lot of attention, that it could be Paul McGann, that it could be Matt Smith.
We can safely say it won't be Eccleston.
It definitely won't be Eccleston. and I don't think it'll be John Hurt. I stand by my final thought in my theory that I do think the Time Lords are going to come back in one form or another. And I also generally believe that Clara will be in episode 12. In one form or another.
I think you're right.
Whether that ends up that she's still dead and she's in some happy heaven-like state with Danny Pink or not, I hope it's not that. I really do.
I hope you can hear the face I'm making.
It wasn't pleasant.
No.
she's going to be in episode 12 in some form or another. Yeah, you're right. Missy's probably going to be back in it. The Daleks are probably going to be back in it. It's going to be a whiz-bang thing. I know the episodes are longer. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah, well, they start at 8:05 and they go on until...
Yeah, I think episode 11 is something like 60 or 55 minutes and 12 is 65 minutes, something like that. And also, I think the other reason is that they've been saving the money up for this. Because I know the budgets have probably been cut because of the BBC cuts, but by doing two-part episodes for the whole season, they've probably saved a lot of money on sets and cast and characters and things.
Well, this was effectively a bottle episode once you got past Riggsy's domestic situation. We were just in the streets.
In one set, yeah.
Well, it was a contained minimal number of sets, yeah.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see a big blowout in certainly, maybe not in 11, but definitely in 12. They're going to throw all the money at the wall and it's going to be some big extravaganza. I'm looking forward to it.
And on that note, thank you so much, Kev, for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
And hopefully I'll get to hear your thoughts on the finale in the next episode of the Doctor Who review show.
Thank you very much.
Alright guys, who would you like to snog from this week's episode, and why? I think I'd like to snog Clara because Jane Austen says she's a great kisser. No, seriously, I'd like to snog her because after I was so sad and disappointed with how I felt about her character in the previous series, in this one, the writing and her portrayal, Jenna Coleman's acting, it's pulled me right back in. Yeah, definitely snog. Alright guys, what would you marry from this week's episode, and why? Hands down, I'd like to marry the writer, Aussie Sarah Dollard. Not out of parochialism, mind you, but the fact she wrote something here that felt a bit different and a bit special. It wasn't a world beater, it wasn't a number one, it wasn't a bullseye, but it was good and new. Fresh blood for Doctor Who, you can come again, Sarah. Okay, what would you avoid from this week's episode, and why? Well, aside from the obvious one of avoiding the Raven, I think Maisie Williams' character of Ashilda is a bit played out at this point. I think this trilogy of episodes we've seen her in has told a particular story. I probably wouldn't like to see her coming back too often. I do know a lot of people don't like her portrayal. I'm not as worried as them about it, I've got to say, but I just don't think it's a character with long-term possibilities. Even a character like River Song, who was sort of designed to have long-term possibilities, got played out in the end. And I think for a character like Ashilda, these three episodes, knock it on the head, Stephen, I think we're done.
As far as Face the Raven, what did I really like about this episode? I don't know if I'm ready to talk about this yet. It was a really interesting episode, and it kept you guessing till the end. And even though I already knew how it was going to end, I was still really curious to see how it would get there. And then, of course, we all pretty much knew how it was going to end, but that doesn't mean we have to like it. I guess maybe the manner in which she died was kind of traumatic to be a witness to see that happen. I don't know if that is perhaps the best way they could have handled that. Maybe they didn't have to show it all on screen.
What would I snug? I would snug the TARDIS. I mean, I would normally snug the TARDIS. I've always found it a little bit sexy, which is, I suppose, weird. But just seeing her there, covered in flowers, covered in graffiti, paintings of Clara. Oh, it was beautiful and quite sad. And I suppose Mary would be Jenna Coleman. And I don't mean that in a kind of straightforward, core, she's hot and wasn't that a tight top kind of way. Just that her performance has, for years now, transcended the usual level of companion performance. And she's become such a big deal to the show. And she's so much more than just an actress in it. She's been absolutely amazing. And what a strong final episode for her. And I would avoid a Shilda like the plague. A, because she could quite easily have me killed. And B, because, as someone else said, there is a faint tang of the GCSE drama final about her. And that's all in the past, and I don't need to revisit that.
Right, so thinking back to Face the Raven.
Fraser's Raven,
yeah. Thinking back to that. In that episode, these are the questions. Who would you snog, marry, or avoid? So, who would you snog in that episode?
What the hell are these questions?
Exactly, I don't know. Marry?
What the hell are these questions?
And avoid.
I didn't realise Rev was three.
So, any...
No, you're not getting my input.
Okay, all right, there we go. Lovely, thank you.
What would I snog from this week's episode? And by the way, this is a term I have never used before. Snog. What a strange way to say kiss. It seems like something a pig would do, you know? Like snog, snort, snog. Okay, all right. What would I snog? What would I snog? That's better. I think I would snog the tattoos. Those were very cool. It was classic. It piques your interest. It was kind of spooky and timey-wimey at the same time, you know, using quantum physics, I guess. I think I would marry the way that Clara left the show. All the words that were spoken were beautiful. I would marry those words. Here's what I hated, though. It was pretty cheap how they didn't explain how the tattoo process works and how that's tied to death. Because if a little bit more information was given, you can bet the doctor would have found a way to save Clara. But the writers copped out on us, and they chose us to not reveal that information or go into depth. Despite that being the natural direction for the doctor to take, it was cheap and harsh.
You have been listening to Andy, Beth, Al, The Him, Little Bo, Lex, Kate, Rob, Ian, and Kev. And our very special guest star was Mr. J.R. Southall! Yay! You can find out all about us at thedwshow.net. And find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching The DW Show, that's with a capital D and a capital W. And you can email us at hello@thedwshow.net. The DW is in capitals. Our theme tune is by Dominic Glynn and is available as part of the Gallifrey Mixes on Amazon and iTunes. Thanks for listening.